Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program. Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls. This week on KiteLine, we'll focus on the topic of education in prison. We'll hear from Dr. Scarlett Brooks, who has taught English and writing in prisons, and whose PhD dissertation explored prisons as an important anchor and source of the writings of Black cultural nationalism between 1930 to 1980. Later, we'll hear some reflections from Maureen, who also has experience teaching art in Indiana prisons. We will also share a letter written by Zolo, a longtime prisoner in Indiana. But first, here's some recent prison-related news.
Chelsea Manning, sentenced to 35 years for leaking over 700,000 documents revealing U.S. military secrets about the Iraq War, had her sentence commuted this week. She will be released in May. While held in a men's military prison, she fought for her ability to gender transition, going so far as to conduct a hunger strike earlier this year. Her struggle has set an important precedent for other prisoners. We have also received news that Oscar Lopez Rivera, a community organizer and member of the Armed Forces of National Liberation, an urban guerrilla group dedicated to Puerto Rican independence, has also received a commutation, ending his 32 years in captivity. He had earlier refused a pardon by Bill Clinton on the grounds that it would have left two other imprisoned comrades behind.
On January 16th, the American Civil Liberties Union issued a damning report called Caged In, Solitary Confinement's Devastating Harm on Prisoners with Physical Disabilities. As damaging as solitary confinement can be for prisoners without disabilities, it can prove to be horrendous for those with them. Current and formerly incarcerated people with disabilities interviewed for the report described putting up with the extreme isolation of solitary confinement for extensive periods of time, some lasting years. They were left without wheelchairs or prosthetic limbs. Many of them had no means to walk, shower, clothe themselves, or use the toilet. In 1990, the federal government passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, which mandates equal access and protections for people with disabilities. The act is not being applied to prisoners with disabilities, however. They're sometimes placed in solitary confinement simply because there is a lack of adequate prison housing for them.
Ongoing right-wing attacks on women's reproductive rights have greatly limited access to abortion, and access is even more difficult for women in prison. Tennessee inmate Keshawara Cathy discovered she was pregnant after she entered jail, and has filed a lawsuit against the Maury County Sheriff, contending that he denied her request for an abortion. The lawsuit alleges that the sheriff refused to provide transportation or funding for the procedure because the pregnancy didn't risk Kathy's life and wasn't the result of rape or incest. The sheriff also said Cathy chose to continue the pregnancy, but her lawsuit says she never had a choice and underwent a, quote, cruel and unusual, unquote, ordeal. An obstetrician, gynecologist, and researcher at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine observed that prisoners have a constitutional right to health care, but the lack of written policies on such procedures as abortion can deny the incarcerated needed care.
In Massachusetts on Monday, a serious prison uprising broke out in the Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center. It took 3 hours to suppress the riot, with guards wielding pepper spray and flooding the block. About 45 prisoners had participated in the uprising, smashing furniture, cameras, and computers inside the guard station. This comes amid growing concern about poor conditions and overcrowding in U.S. prisons. Now we'll hear from Dr. Brooks, who spoke with us over the phone recently.
I really came to the issue by three different avenues. The first one was through my dissertation. The second was my teaching the prison inmate education program, or teaching in the inmate education program through Indiana State University in Terre Haute. And the last avenue by which I came to this was the Inside Out program. I thought I would, you know, try to find a way to go into prison just to kind of have contact with inmates and see how correctional education was carried out in a practical fashion, because when I was researching Etheridge Knight, he was incarcerated in the 60s, maybe early 70s, and that was a progressive time for inmate education. And so the inmates themselves, you know, there was a lot of programming that was sponsored or supported by the prison, but at the same time, there was a lot of intellectual activity among the inmates just sort of organizing themselves to find out what they wanted to study or study what they wanted to pursue, and they were drawing on each other for resources. You know, and a lot of the art, the writing, was generated from those spontaneous groups. So I kind of wanted to see how inmate education was carried out today and whether there were still avenues for inmates to pursue creative and intellectual activities and how that might be similar to or different from what was happening during that very progressive period in the 60s and 70s. I do want to say, and this is very important, that I wasn't doing any formal research on the inmates, and nothing that happened while I was teaching came into the dissertation because that would be unethical. I just thought it would be hard for me to continue to write about prisons never having set foot in one. I found a job through Indiana State, who had a very robust program at the time, and I taught English 105 to inmates at Plainfield, Putnamville, and the federal prison in Terre Haute. And I did that for a whole school year, which I believe was fall of 2010 through spring of 2011. From a practical or logistical point of view, I had to be really organized going in because all the material that you introduce to the inmates has to be approved, I guess for the obvious reasons. And also they don't have access to technology. Everything has to be done on paper. So from a practical standpoint, I put together, you know, my whole course essentially into a packet and got the entire packet approved and then was able to, you know, just sort of go forward with very little oversight by Indiana State University. In terms of the social atmosphere of the classroom, I have to say it was great. I'm not sure exactly how the inmates get into the course. I'm sure they have to apply by some formal means, but also, as I understood it, the inmates saw their participation as a privilege that, I guess, could be revoked. And that's an assumption, but they were the very best behaved, very respectful, and very eager to learn. I never had one problem. So people, I think, assumed that it was a difficult teaching experience, but actually it was one of the easiest teaching jobs I've ever had, if only because the inmates really understand that their participation or their access to education is a privilege, and they definitely don't want to do anything to compromise the privilege. The other social aspect was that I'd never taught in an environment that was not co-ed. And so with Jeff Mills in the class, I was able to develop new ways of teaching, which I think were necessary because I know some people would have a problem with my saying this, but in that particular environment with Jeff Mills in prison, the students, they really kind of like to learn socially and hands-on, like with less direct instruction or lecture from the teacher. So a lot of my activities were designed for participation in small groups, for the inmates to share ideas and sort of teach each other and then bring their ideas to the whole class or produce some writing that, of course, I would grade. But it was very relaxed. It was very relaxed. The students were very cooperative, and the main thing I noticed from a social standpoint is that they really responded to the small group sort of hands-on approach with very little direct lecture from me. Academically, the students were very strong. I mean, they would compare with any college freshman that I've ever taught. I will say that they tended to be, in terms of like writing any personal narrative or something along those lines, they tended to be very open. Some of them wrote about their crimes. Of course, I never asked about anyone's crimes or looked them up. I really didn't want to know what people were in there for. But sometimes, you know, the students would take a sort of humorous or sanguine attitude toward their crimes, and they would write about those as well. So the writing itself ended up being very, very entertaining. I taught 105 and 107. So the 105 class is similar to like Ivy Tech 111. It's articulated with W131 at IU. And that course is not research oriented. It's more learning how to, you know, mastering different forms. So, you know, you start with your personal narrative and then you write a descriptive essay and, you know, you write a compare and contrast and a cause and effect and so on. And so I really didn't have to bring in a lot of resources for them. It was more about giving them models for the kinds of essays they were writing. And most of the class was talking about the models, talking about strategies, writing workshop, peer review, that sort of thing. So I didn't even feel the constraints very much in that course. The 107, which I recall clearest in my mind, teaching at Putnamville and the federal prison, that was a research course, the 107. And so they did have a book, and so that book has models in it, but they also had to generate a research paper. There was no personal narrative or anything in that course. So I would say the main difference was that I think I put together three different packets where I had hand-selected the sources, the research sources, and so, you know, they couldn't select their own sources. But for the most part, it was just, you know, it was Indiana State University curriculum, and I was very comfortable with the work that they did. I should also say that considering that you did have some very high-quality work, you know, coming out of prison, I wonder whether there was almost a, dare I say, a positive side to it or an upside to it, and that there's almost a sort of monastic dimension to incarceration. And I say this, you know, with great hesitance, but, you know, out of all bad, some good can come. And so what I had assumed while I was researching and what was confirmed for me in a way when I was teaching was that, you know, the students who really wanted to pursue academics or some kind of creative endeavor had the time and space, maybe the resources were limited, but, you know, to really kind of delve into that and explore their talents outside of a lot of the distractions, you know, in the non-carceral world. The last year, the last semester that I taught for Indiana State was the last year that they actually had the program, because the next legislative session of the assembly in Indianapolis, they actually voted to severely reduce funding for prison education. And so I actually probably would have kept the job, but the program got defunded. What I learned from my research is that a lot of people experience very severe educational inequality. And you can see that, you know, as a teacher as well, and sort of assume what the results could be if a person has a superior education. You know, as a lifelong educator, I do firmly believe, I sincerely believe that education can change lives. I just don't see a downside to education ever.
Next, Maureen will share some of her experiences teaching in prison.
I would say one thing that was rewarding about teaching in a prison was, one, I felt like people were very present because they don't have many distractions, you know? Like, there's not the constant pull of the internet or a smartphone because they can't have them. And I think they're just really bored. So being in a classroom was stimulating, even if it maybe wasn't a subject that they were interested in. And I felt that they were more awake in a way than when I was teaching in regular settings where people are slightly distracted by their everyday lives and like the running to-do list of things that you have to do to just be an adult. And then if they're not interested in the subject matter, I really feel it, you know, when there are people in the classroom who are like, oh, okay, let's rally, let's pay attention. But I felt like at the prison, they were just all very awake, you know, they were awake and ready to hear something else beyond what they had, which is like really limited exposure to things. So that was rewarding. And then I felt like there was a lack of like, how to say it, reserve in a really refreshing way, you know, especially teaching art. I feel like a lot of the guys didn't have like any exposure to art in a way that was like really surprising to me. because they had no exposure to a lot of the art we were talking about, they also hadn't been exposed to, like, the elitism of the art world and a feeling like, I can't say I don't like a Picasso because it's a freaking Picasso. It was really refreshing to hear just, like, an honest sort of, like, this is not working for me, and I am not ashamed to say it, you know? Like, everybody was just, like, very outspoken about their feelings about things. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in college, there's more of an insecurity to say if you don't like something, or you just, you know. So it's kind of refreshing to be, like, keep me on my toes. Like, yeah, let's talk about why this is, like, actually, like, an important piece of artwork. And sometimes I would win them over, and sometimes I just wouldn't, and, you know, I just had to let that go. I was in the classroom alone with them. A lot of people asked me if there was a guard in the room, and there was never a guard. So there's no guard in the room or outside the room, but I just felt a protection from the group, you know? Like, if there was one guy that maybe had some ill will in any way, I just felt like the other guys in the room were just not gonna let it happen. I felt very protected by the group. There were certain individuals that made me uncomfortable, and I made a little side note to myself to never be alone with mm-hmm. them in the hallway or in the classroom, but the group itself I felt very protected by. Mm-hmm. And that was in the classroom and also just, like, in the prison in general. In fact, one of the freakiest times for me was when I was alone with a guard, because I had to get an ID at one point, and we went deep into this, like, maze, this, like, prison maze to go and get my ID photographed. And there was a lot of, like, I felt a lot of tension between the guards and me, and I know some of the other teachers expressed it as well, because I think there was a lot of, like, resentment that the prisoners were being exposed to this level of education. And I don't know, there was weird resentment there. And so this guard in particular, I just felt like he was especially angry or bitter. And I was alone with him for maybe 25 minutes in these, you know, there was one point where, you know, every time you enter and exit a building, you're locked in between these two doors that you have no control of being opened. And I remember thinking at one point, like, I am deep within this maze of nobody's around. It's just the two of us. We're locked in between these, like, two gated doors, and I'm really scared. So the atmosphere, I guess, is just, like, the fact that everything's locked and concealed is frightening regardless of, mm-hmm. you know, if someone's passed.
Yeah, because you're, I mean, it's someone else's responsibility to get you in and out.
Yeah.
Like,
you don't have
that choice. There's no agency. You can't mm-hmm. just be like, all right, I'm out of here.
Right.
Because you're so deep in it.
Exactly. It's a kind of claustrophobic feeling.
Yeah.
It's depressing, you know, like, you're like locked in this space you can't easily get out of, and it's everything is like gray and off-white colored. And then the walk to the classroom where I taught, I had to walk by the dorms where they all lived. You can't see anybody, you can just hear them. It's like a weird feeling, being able to enter that space once a week and leave and then come back once a week. And I think it's just like a good reality check more than anything, because to see like the way that other people are living like that, especially as someone who's grew up sort of middle class and naive. mm-hmm. The power dynamic is odd, especially as I think as a like somewhat petite woman, I've never really felt like I had power over somebody, like physically. mm-hmm. But when you're in the classroom, we were instructed to call them by their last names, very like military sort of mm-hmm. setup, because that's how they are called by like the guards and everybody else, and we were instructed to keep that up, which was peculiar for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not like, the way that I teach in general is not very like authoritative, so it was hard for me to step into that role. And I think that if I did it now, I wonder, because it was a few years ago, I was a little, you know, obviously a little bit younger, I think maybe I wouldn't feel so awkward. I felt very out of place sometimes with that role of like, I'm in charge, you better listen to me. So yeah, that was a slightly uncomfortable, that expectation, I guess, on my part. And I think as a woman, I feel like my boss and the guards and the other, especially men that I taught with, were constantly instructing me to act a certain way in, you know, like puffing myself up in a way around them that just never really felt comfortable for me. Because I just don't have a lot. I'm not very convincible in that role of like, better not mess with me.
Right.
And I really didn't feel like it was appropriate, I guess. There was a few times where I felt like I had to step up into that. But most of the time, I didn't really feel like anybody... I felt like everybody respected my position and their position, and you know, as a teacher in a classroom. I had this one student who I really loved, and I totally pegged him for different than he turned out being when he walked into the classroom. On the first day, I thought... Quite frankly, I thought, oh, he's scary, and I don't want to be alone with him, ever. And I thought he was going to be difficult, because he kind of had this, like, don't mess with me look on his face at all times. And while I was talking, he just kind of looked at me like, you know, skepticism about what I was saying, and it made me nervous. And he turned out to be just, I think, one of my favorite students of all times, because he was so invested and so curious. I remember one chapter we talked about the Renaissance, and you know, I had never taught history before, so I was totally in that place, like 3 weeks ahead, 2 weeks ahead of the students sort of situation. And I have an education about art history for my own curiosity and for my own college background, but I've never really, you know, formally taught it before, so I was overwhelmed with the amount of detail that I had, information that I had to give. So anyway, I was not fully prepared for this, like, chapter on the Renaissance. It could only really handle talking about, like, you know, the most obvious artists. And so I gave the lecture, and I did as, you know, good of a job as I could. And he raised his hand afterwards, like, really, like, upset looking. I forget his name, but I called on him, and he was, like, upset that we had not covered Donatello, because he had read ahead. He read the whole chapter. And I remember I was like, man, you're calling me out. Like, in any other class, this would be like a godsend. Like, thank you. Yes. Keep the conversation going. I love that you're so curious. But I was sitting there like sweating, like, seriously, are you going to like throw me under the rug? It's like, well, we are not talking about Donatello. We might talk about him next week, but it was so uncomfortable. Like, how could you? How could you not look at this man? Look at what he did. It was such beautiful work. How could you not do, like, what kind of teacher are you? He was great.
Here is a letter that has been shared with us by Zolo, a longtime Indiana prisoner.
On May 26th, 2016, I began working in the federally funded Prison Enterprise Network joint venture for minimum wage at the Miami Correctional Facility. On June 8, 2016, I had been rushed at quitting time to sign a faded copy of a private sector prison industry enhancement form. It states that room and board expenses at 40% of my gross income will be deducted. On June 9, 2016, I was verbally attacked and summarily fired from my minimum wage earning job at the Prison Enterprise Network by plant manager Sandra Rourke. I was rehired the same day, however, in the assistance of the assistant superintendent Sharon Hawk. The incident arose when I simply questioned clause number 2 of the private sector Prison Enterprise Network contract about 40% room and board deductions. I subsequently signed the contract about 10 days later. On June 13th, 2016, I lodged an objection and formal written complaint challenging clause number 2 of the contract and made it available to the Indiana Department of Corrections, Prison Enterprise Network, and the public at large. 60% of $7.25 is $4.35. The agreement with the DOC commissioner is for the $7.25 an hour minimum wage. The 60% that would be left for me after the questionable 40% room and board deduction is for below what I was promised. Moreover, the 40% is taken out before taxes. Sinister activity involving lots of money changing hands under false pretenses behind closed doors in high places of the Indiana DOC and private corporations for profit has become an ongoing secret covenant. It currently costs an average of $53.96 per day to house an adult prison inmate at the Indiana Department of Corrections. On August 4th, 2016, the Department of Corrections and Prison Enterprise Network presented the prisoner workers with a new contract 2 months after I made my challenge to Clause 2 that replaced room and board with an administration fee. The first Prison Enterprise Network contract was binding on all parties and shall remain in force until the termination of my employment or until canceled by me in writing. I refused to sign the new contract, which would have canceled the previous contract contemporaneously or at the same time. On August 22, 2016, I was fired as punishment in retaliation for accusing the MCF and Prison Enterprise Network officials of double-dipping. I was the shop janitor. The money itemized as room and board, accommodations or lodging, ghost payment expenses, from deductions of my gross minimum wage janitorial job income, were diverted to MCF and Prison Enterprise Network private sector accounts. There was never any actual room and board. The funds were fraudulently skimmed through trickery and deceit and funneled to somebody and someplace else for personal gain. On August 31st, 2016, I was reclassed back to the Prison Enterprise Network garment shop slaving for 35 cents per hour as retribution without a due process hearing in reprisal for complaining about the bogus room and board deductions. I learned rapidly the first time I started here in early spring this year what it is to experience toiling in a running sweatshop for mere pennies. Prisoner workers who earn minimum wage income only pay for room and board at work release centers and private prisons. I was deceived and misled to sign the Prison Enterprise Network padded contract under false pretenses because the prison cell in which I am confined, MCF, was already paid for with taxpayer money allocated by the Indiana General Assembly. The Prison Enterprise Network also monopolized the Department of Corrections Prison Commissary in Indiana, and they both receive kickbacks through commissary repurchases. The Prison Enterprise Network actually runs the entire commissary for the state, so whenever my personal property is stolen or confiscated, I then have to buy that stuff again from the Prison Enterprise Network company, doing multi-million dollar business inside the Department of Corrections. The public at large is hoodwinked about the MCF problem. I am constantly harassed on a daily basis and placed squarely in the crosshairs of vengeful Department of Corrections and Prison Enterprise Network administrators for blowing the whistle. MCF officials also violate my rights by withholding and delivering my mail in an untimely manner. The free speech clause of the First Amendment applies to communications between an inmate and the outside world. I'm also denied the right to practice my Islamic faith. The most problematic cabal is the ongoing administrative cover-up perpetrated at the highest levels of the Department of Corrections policymakers. The DOC relation with the Prison Enterprise Network group is a racketeering enterprise. In the public interest of transparency and ethical accountability, I am urging you to help me in any way you can. Please treat my letter as a press release. Thank you.
This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message or share a story to be played on the air at 812-269-2517. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one. You can find previous episodes of KiteLine or more information on our stories at kitelineradio.noblogs.org. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across the prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. to hear more stories, news, and insights about Indiana's prison system and its impact on our communities. Thank you for listening.